We are ready to proceed on to the next case. If the clerk would call the case, please.
The court would now call Miss Jones LLC versus Walker Murray Randall et al. May it please the court. Miss Jane Weber will argue for the appellant. Mr. Russell Barton will argue for the appellee.
Ms. Weber.
May it please the court. The issue before this court involves the appropriate interplay between the gas royalty provision in paragraph 3 of the preprinted portion of the leases and paragraph 26 of the addendum of the leases. The parties agree that the leases are unambiguous, but they disagree on what those unambiguous terms mean at the end of the day. And that's the task for the court here. What do those terms mean at the end of the day? And ending up at the right place in interpretation of these leases with the correct interpretation requires careful attention to the journey, I think, of how we get there. The journey includes the process of analyzing the plain terms and the applicable principles of contract construction, of considering the leases as a whole, and most important, attempting to harmonize all the provisions, if at all possible. Now, among the applicable principles that impact the court's task in this interplay is the fact that the Supreme Court of Texas has instructed that where royalty calculation, in particular, is concerned, not every term in an oil and gas royalty clause will necessarily have meaning. We know that from the Heritage case, where an express no deductions clause was deemed surplusage as a matter of law. We know that from the Hyder case 20 years later, where the court said the same thing, that an express provision disclaiming the Heritage principle was deemed surplusage as a matter of law. And so that is one of the applicable contract principles that this court needs to bring to bear in interpreting these particular leases. Another important consideration in the journey of how do we get to the right interpretation in these leases is the fact that paragraph 26 in the addendum is copied and pasted from the state lease promulgated by the General Land Office that's applicable to Relinquishment Act lands. And that is significant to the interpretation here for two distinct reasons. First, the fact that paragraph 26 is cut and pasted from a state lease, which governs, has very, very different provisions and very particular provisions given the nature of the Relinquishment Act and the fact that the state is something of an 800-pound gorilla where oil and gas leasing is concerned. The fact that this clause, these two sentences, was plucked out of the Relinquishment Act GLO lease and plopped down in these leases, it highlights the need for careful attention to the process and the principles involved in lease construction, because these leases are Frankenstein monsters. The addendum is filled with a whole bunch of short and disparate provisions. They're not a cohesive whole. And like a Frankenstein monster, if you take an arm from here and a leg from there and a finger from over here, they don't always fit together. And while the provisions in the addendum, yes, they do supersede the provisions in the preprinted portion to the extent of a conflict, of an actual conflict between them, but given the nature of this Frankenstein monster, of this cobbled together lease, it's especially important for the court to take care and give due regard to the principles involved of carefully going through the terms, of harmonizing them if at all possible, of not having a hair trigger or looking with blinders on at any of the provisions to elevate one over another. Now, the second reason I submit that the cut and pasting, the paragraph 26 coming from the state lease, the second reason that is significant is that that provision and its interaction with a royalty clause, with a complete royalty clause, was very thoroughly analyzed, and that was interpreted in the Sandridge case. And I submit to the court that the Sandridge case will be, it gives important and helpful guidance in how to put these two together. And the Sandridge...
But the Sandridge case, really, we're only dealing with one sentence that says it was surplusage under heritage. There wasn't much analysis in that case as to what the gross value provision meant.
Well, if you look at Sandridge just narrowly like that, but if you look, Your Honor, look a little further, if you look at the paragraph above that, where the court discusses the that a provision in paragraph 4B of the state lease was an Izaguirre backstop. That analysis, together with its determining that its paragraph 7, our paragraph 26, was surplusage as a matter of law, what the court looked at, paragraph 4B, the issue in Sandridge, the core issue was whether paragraph 4B was a market value at the well or a gross proceeds lease. That was the whole issue. And the court had a number of pages of analysis of that, precisely that issue. And the paragraph 4B had the phrase in it. It discussed market value at the well, the gross production, value paid on the highest market price. And then the provision said the value, highest market price, or the gross price paid or offered to the producer, whichever is greater. And there was some analysis, did that make gross price paid or offered to the producer? Did that make this a gross proceeds provision? And the court said, no, that's an Izaguirre backstop. That is to ameliorate against the possibility that the price actually received down the line is higher than the market value at the well. And then immediately after analyzing the interplay between market value and the gross price received in 4B, then came the analysis, okay, and what does paragraph 7 impact? And they said, oh, paragraph 7, they brushed it off, and they said, no, this is, that's surplusage as a matter of law. And so I think that looking at what the Sandridge court did, the whole issue was, is this a gross proceeds lease? And if the second sentence of paragraph 7 provided changed the fundamental royalty valuation from market value at the well to gross value realized, which is what the summary judgment here held, wouldn't you think that would have impacted the court's analysis, given that that was the whole issue in the Sandridge case? And yet, no. And what is telling, I think, in the trial court, the summary judgment hearing in this case, the first summary judgment hearing in this case was held after the Sandridge opinion came out while it was still pending at the Supreme Court of Texas. And at that summary judgment hearing, Mr. Sims, for the arguing on behalf of the lessors, his argument to the court was, no, you don't need to follow Sandridge because it's fixing to get reversed. And what he said, it appears that the argument appears at volume 2 of the reporter's record at page 26. And he says that the GLO case, the Sandridge case, it's pending at the Texas Supreme Court. They've asked for full briefing on the merits. And my guess is they're going to reverse the El Paso Court of Appeals because of the inherent ambiguity of the two provisions in that lease. That GLO case conflicts with the Texas Supreme Court's decisions dealing with language about gross value received versus at the well. And yet what the Supreme Court did was deny review. They denied review. And so
how do you respond to the argument that this isn't a backstop provision because it doesn't have the provided that language?
Well, neither did the language in the Sandridge case have a provided that. You can draft a backstop provision there's no magical language to do that. And again, given that it was cut and pasted from another lease, of course it doesn't have the particular verbiage. The question is, can it serve?
Thank you for helping me with the pronunciation of Izaguirre. But with Izaguirre and Heritage, they're usually talking about a backstop provision that uses the terms amount realized, aren't they?
Well, you can use amount realized, gross proceeds, amount of value received. There's not a magical
is there a case other than arguably Heritage that uses the term gross value received to define a backstop provision?
Well, I don't think that that Heritage spoke in terms of a backstop provision, Your Honor.
But Judge Baker was talking about, he did reference Izaguirre and talked about why the additional language was in there as reflecting the backstop problem that you're describing in your brief, and he used the term amount realized when he was discussing that problem, didn't he?
I don't know what term he used, but I believe Heritage predated Izaguirre.
Okay, what's the case that predates Izaguirre with the opposite side of the problem?
Vela.
Okay.
The Vela case.
Describing a Vega problem.
The issue in Vela is the same as the issue in Izaguirre, which was a situation where the economics made a mismatch between market value and actual proceeds. And a backstop, if you will, that's the term we used here. It's not a magical term. That I just slapped that as a label to explain a circumstance where this provision can serve to align, to ensure that the interests of the lessor and the lessee under the lease are aligned for royalty calculation purposes. Sort of, we're in this boat together. Whatever marketing I do, whatever dollar amount, proceeds, value, gross amount received, gross price paid, whatever it is that I'm able to get, you're going to be able to share in it. We're together in good times and in bad. The Vela came out before the pre-printed portion of the lease was drafted, and so it's provided for in the paragraph, the original paragraph 3. Izaguirre obviously came out afterwards, and the second sentence of paragraph 26 can serve as an Izaguirre backstop by requiring a net back manner of arriving at valuation at the well, as opposed to a comparable sales method. Because the Supreme Court has...
All paragraph 26 says is lessee agrees to compute and pay royalties on the gross value received, and I'll leave out the including paragraph. Where does the verbiage of that statement, of that sentence, suggest that it's acting in some type of backstop capacity?
Well, Your Honor, going back to what I started out with, it's important to take this in logical steps. The journey of this one is important. And the journey has to start with paragraph 3. What does paragraph 3 tell us? There are 4 or 5 different royalty valuation yardsticks. There's oil taken in kind. There's oil purchased by the lessor, on which royalties are to be paid at the market price then prevailing in the field where and when produced. There's taking the oil and selling it, in which case royalties are on the amounts received valued at the well. There's gas sold or used off the premises, where royalties are based on market value at the well. Or there's gas sold on the premises, in which case royalties are based on amounts received. So there are different yardsticks. And what this says is, agrees to compute and pay royalties on the gross value received. Does that apply to all 5 of them? What's it intended to apply to? Does it amend all of them? The only one that's at issue under the facts of this case is the gas sold or used off the premises, because that's the product and the marketing method that's at issue. But interpretation of paragraph 26 has to be meaningful for all the different permutations of potential sales under the language of this lease. It can't just be a ticket good for one day and one train only. And it doesn't quite fit, again, because it's a Frankenstein monster. So when we're trying to look at where you have a full and complete and integrated royalty provision, as you have in paragraph 3, and then you have this one random sentence. Well, how do we harmonize them? How do we make it all fit together? One way to make it fit together is if you construe it as an indication that the method of arriving at market value at the well starts with gross value received to arrive at a valuation at the well, because at the well is a significant venture. The Williams and Myers treatise, which I submit to you is one of the most authoritative in oil and gas, tells us that if you
ever you may have to wait and tell us about that on your rebuttal. Your time has expired. Thank you very much. Mr. Barton.
May it please the court. I've provided a handout to the court and that has three tabs, and under tab A, the bottom of page 1, is the gross value received clause in paragraph 26 of the addendum. And it says that lessee agrees to compute and pay royalties on the gross value received. None of Bluestone's harmonizing arguments, whether it's couched as a netback method or a backstop method, none of them result in royalty being computed and certainly not paid on the gross value received. They require the court to change gross value into net value. Up at the top of page 1 is the superseding clause in the addendum. It says the parties understand and agree that the language in the addendum supersedes any provisions to the contrary in the printed lease hereof. According to Bluestone's oral argument handout, the superseding clause is not even relevant. But here,
let me ask
dispositive.
You a clarifying question, if I can. There was your all's briefs were excellent, but there was only a little bit of did not. We have 12 leases, right?
Yes.
And so we have 12 addendums.
That's correct.
And do all the addendums have the superseding clause that's referenced on your page 1?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The market value at the well clause in the printed form plainly is contrary to the gross value received clause. The word contrary that's used in the superseding clause, that word means a fact or condition that's incompatible with another. By definition, the word gross means undiminished by deduction. The gross value received clause prohibits the deduction of post-production costs. The market value at the well clause requires the deduction. The gross value received clause requires a gross royalty payment. The market value at the well clause requires a net royalty payment. In Judas, the Supreme Court held that a proceeds type clause, like the gross value received clause, that clause inherently conflicts with a market value at the well clause, that they are opposite. And in Heritage, Justice Owen's concurring opinion, she says that those two clauses are irreconcilable. Nothing can be more contrary than something that is the opposite of something else. Under the superseding clause, the parties plainly agreed that the gross value received clause supersedes, it takes the place of, the market value at the well clause.
If you just had the first sentence of paragraph 26, no matter what the superseding clause said, you'd be under Heritage, right?
No, Your Honor. Not without the superseding clause, this lease would be ambiguous because it would be a Judas problem where you have gross net. What Hyder makes clear is that a no deducts clause, the first sentence of paragraph 26, if you have a proceeds type provision like the gross value received clause is. Hyder says the no deducts clause is surplusage to that. It's not surplusage to a market value at the well clause. So here, the gross value received clause under Hyder, in and of itself, by definition, gross value received precludes deductions.
And maybe I may not be communicating, but if you didn't have the second sentence of paragraph 26, if you only had the first sentence of paragraph 26, the first sentence of paragraph 26 is basically the same kind of surplusage language that was found in Heritage.
I'm sorry. Yes, I think that's right.
Okay. So we're down to basically two questions here: what the effect of the superseding clause is and what the effect is of the words gross value received in the second sentence of paragraph 26.
That's correct. And the gross value received, by definition, is without deduction.
And her argument is you shouldn't allow that second sentence to upset the whole apple cart. Your argument is that sentence, irrespective of everything else, controls.
Her argument sacrifices the plain meaning of the gross value received clause on the altar of harmonization. And that requires the court to just rewrite the leases. The netback method that she referred to, I think, is now as part of the backstop argument. The netback method, netting the price back to the well by deducting cost, is the opposite of computing and paying royalty on the gross value received, which is what the gross value received clause requires. That argument requires the court to delete the words compute and pay out of the gross value received clause and somehow rewrite it to not be the opposite, to not be irreconcilable.
But isn't that exactly the result that Sandridge reached?
No. Sandridge is simply distinguishable. Number one, it held some other clause besides the gross value received clause operated as a backstop. The fundamental difference between this case and Sandridge is that Sandridge did not have a superseding clause saying that the gross value received clause superseded anything contrary to it. And there wasn't an addendum at all.
You had one document.
The court is just trying to reconcile and harmonize, and they end up applying the gross value received clause to royalty provisions that were not market value at the well. But there was no superseding clause. It's simply distinguishable. There's no evidence that paragraph 26 in these leases were cut and pasted from some state lease. The fact that leases have similar or the same terms does not mean that they're cut and pasted from the state's lease that was at issue in Sandridge. And they're not even identical. The no deducts clause in Sandridge was not identical to what we have here. So that's a red herring. Sandridge itself is just distinguishable. Doesn't control here. Bluestone does not cite any case where the lease had both a proceeds type royalty clause and a superseding clause. Not a one. Under their arguments, the court would have to say gross value received means net value received, and that the superseding clause does not mean what it plainly says. The plain meaning of the leases say that the gross value received clause supersedes. It takes the place of the market value at the well clause. The judgments should be affirmed on that issue. I want to briefly talk about the trial court's rulings with respect to plant fuel and compressor fuel. Under tab A of the handout on page 2, the royalty clause up at the top there requires royalty to be paid on gas used off the premises. The free use clause allows the free use of water, oil, gas, and coal for lessees' operations hereunder. The clauses should be construed together to give effect to both, to the extent that the free use clause is limited to Bluestone's operations on the lease premises. And that's consistent with paragraph 26 of the addendum, which prohibits the deductions for compression and processing. Bluestone receives value from the plant fuel and the compressor fuel, and so royalty is owed on it. Even under the plain meaning of the free use clause, Bluestone's arguments are without merit. The free use clause applies to operations which lessee may conduct hereunder. Under tab C of the handout is the diagram that we included in our brief that illustrates how Bluestone commingles the Appalese gas with the gas from untold number of other leases. And what it shows is that in the orange box up at the top, that represents the Appalese gas. Bluestone takes it out to the right and then commingles it with gas produced from all these other leases. That commingling occurs prior to it going to Crestwood's processing plant off the lease premises. Under its contract with Crestwood, Bluestone takes the Appalese gas and allows Crestwood to use it to run its processing plant. They don't pay any royalty on it. Crestwood is not the lessee under the lease, and it's not exercising any rights under the lease. And because of the commingling that occurs before it gets to the plant, Crestwood, a non-party, is using the Appalese gas off the lease to process gas from all these other leases. Under no stretch of the imagination does that constitute operations by Bluestone under the Appalese leases. The same problem occurs regarding the compressor fuel. After the commingled gas is processed, it comes out the back of the plant. Some of it goes downstream and gets sold, but Bluestone diverts some of that commingled gas back to all of these other leases, and some of the molecules may come back to the Appalese leases. But because of that commingling, Appalese gas necessarily is being used off premises to power compressors on other leases. Activities benefiting other leases are not operations hereunder. And the royalty clause, the rule under the royalty clause is that royalty gets paid on gas used off the premises. Bluestone says, well, the free use clause is an exception to that rule. But since Bluestone argues that gas can be used off the premises by anyone to benefit all these other leases, the exception just swallows the rule. You would never have royalty being paid on gas used off the premises. The trial court correctly rendered judgment that Bluestone owes royalty on the plant fuel and the compressor fuel. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Weber?
May it please the court, I would like to make three brief points in my rebuttal time. First, Justice Basil, you asked about the superseding clause and its import. And the analysis of the place of the superseding clause and what it means here really is, it's important to bear in mind that whether or not there's a superseding clause, provisions that are in the addendum trump over conflicting provisions that are in the preprinted portion. Typewritten controls over preprinted. Handwritten controls over typewritten. Earlier controls over later. There are all kinds of applicable contract interpretation principles that help you determine which, if you have two clauses that are in conflict, which one's going to supersede over another. Where there's no way to have one supersede over another, that's when you end up with an ambiguity. If you have two conflicting clauses and there's no way that one supersedes another, then you have an ambiguity. So if you look at the whole body of the various cases that have been decided by the Texas courts, starting with Heritage and continuing all the way through, in none of them, except in the Judas case, in none of them where the courts disregarded a provision and said, no, this is surplusage. The existence or non-existence of a superseding clause was irrelevant because the court did not find a conflict. Only if there is a conflict do you need a superseding clause or a principle of superseding, which would exist here. Addendums are going to control over preprinted. Only if there is a conflict do you need to turn to, okay, which one's going to control over the other. In none of the cases finding surplusage did the court need to even get there because they found that things like a no-deducts clause, an express no-deducts clause, an express disclaimer.
But why doesn't Judge Owen's statement in Heritage, where it talks about the division order being based on gross proceeds realized at the well, then she says there is an inherent irreconcilable conflict between gross proceeds and at the well and arriving at the value of the gas.
That was in the Judas case, and she was right there, and here's how that fits in to our case. First, there's no need of a superseding clause or whatnot. Second, those appear in the same royalty provision in the same sentence. Gross proceeds at the well. Gross proceeds at the well, in the same sentence, there's a conflict. There's a conflict between those concepts. There's an ambiguity in what is the appropriate yardstick for the royalty calculation. But in our instance, what we have is a market value at the well royalty provision, and then paragraph 26, whatever it means. But the gross amount, gross value realized, if you agree with us and you construe, you give meaning to that as being akin to an Izagirre backstop and allowing the starting point to be the gross value realized, then you can harmonize those two. They're not in the same sentence. We're not saying gross value received at the well. We're saying you start with gross value received. What does the third party pay to Bluestone? And then you net back to valuation at the well for royalty calculation purposes. They're not in the same sentence. They're two different, they're the beginning and the end of an equation. And that is a way that this court can harmonize it. And my, I know I'm running
so
up against my time.
So we have to change the meaning of gross value to something else to harmonize, don't we?
We're not changing it to something else, Your Honor. We're starting at gross value realized.
But then you want to net back, so that means it doesn't mean gross value.
It means gross value at the point at which it is paid, and then it is netted back to a valuation. Your Honor, the only other possibility would be to take this clause, this Frankenstein monster clause, that also, let me just point out, it refers, the reference is severance taxes. Here's a direct tie to Izaguirre. This says, gross value received, including reimbursements for severance taxes and production-related costs. No third-party purchaser, no purchaser of gas in Texas reimburses for severance taxes. That doesn't exist. It is an unknown in the purchase of natural gas. Where it's not unknown is in long-term gas purchase contracts, specifically in the take-or-pay contract that was at issue in Izaguirre, the same take-or-pay contract that was at issue in the Lenape versus Tennessee Gas Pipeline Company case, that reimbursed for severance taxes. So that would be part of the gross value received.
Okay, we're going to have to stop you there. That's the way it works.
We urge you to reverse the trial court summary judgment and render judgment that the appropriate yardstick is to allow deductions of the costs here and remand the attorney's fees issue.
Thank you both for your arguments here today. They were very helpful.
And excellent set of briefs.
And very good briefs. And we appreciate your hard work. And you are excused.